Scientists, students, Indigenous people, and government officials are gathered in Fairbanks this week to discuss, debate, and plan for the future of Arctic research and policy. Research priorities will be created for the future during this week, and students will take part in a model Arctic Council. There's been a lot of attention on the Arctic in the last year, as the U.S. took the chair of the Arctic Council and President Obama made the first trip to the Arctic by a sitting president. Will the attention result in an increase in resources for an area that lacks infrastructure? We'll discuss the possibilities today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Before we launch into a discussion about the Arctic, I want to give you an Iditarod update. Allie Zirkel just crossed the finish line in Nome. She arrived in third place at 9:42 a.m. with 13 dogs. Dallas Seavey won the Iditarod early this morning in record time. The younger Seavey and six dogs pulled into the finish chute in Nome at 2:20 a.m., setting a new speed record for the race. It's Dallas's fourth win. His father, Mitch Seavey, finished second, arriving 45 minutes after his son with 10 dogs. Brent Sass, who was in position for a third-place finish, is still in White Mountain. His dogs refused to leave the checkpoint, and he blames himself for pushing them too hard. Meanwhile, a group of mushers are racing for a top 10 finish in the last stretch of the trail. That bunch includes Wade Mars, Pete Kaiser, Nicholas Petit, and Jeff King. So, former Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp is now the U.S. State Department Special Representative for the Arctic. Admiral Papp is in Fairbanks and joins us from the studio of KUAC. With him is Richard Glenn. Mr. Glenn is Vice President for Land and Natural Resources for the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. He's also a geologist, a whaling co-captain, and has twice been appointed by the President to the United States Arctic Research Commission. He is the board president of the Barrow Arctic Science Consortium. So welcome, gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us from KUAC in Fairbanks.
Thank you, Laura. It's a delight to be here.
Good morning.
Thanks so much. Admiral Papp, I want to discuss the conference you're attending in Fairbanks, but first, I wanted to get your thoughts on the Arctic Agreement between Canada and the U.S. that was just announced last week when Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau visited D.C. Alaska's congressional delegation is plenty unhappy with it. What can you tell us about why there wasn't more coordination and consultation with Alaska leaders before this agreement was announced?
Well, Laurie, I would kind of take exception with any declarations that say that there was not consultation on this. You know, this is it's not an agreement. What it is a joint statement. It is a consensus between the United States and Canada, our two leaders, on a direction for the way ahead. You know, I choose to look at the positive, and I'm a bit of an optimist. And the fact that we have our president and the Prime Minister of Canada focused on, yes, mostly climate change, but also the Arctic. I mean, for years we've been complaining that senior leadership is not giving enough attention to the Arctic. Over the last year, we've had the president visit Alaska, put some concrete proposals for funding in the next year's budget, and mentioning it in this joint statement with Canada. And it's really based upon, I would say, years of consultation. Just in the 2 years that I've been in this job, I've made many visits to Alaska, done listening sessions, and visited with various groups. Every group from Alaska that visits Washington, D.C., I always have an open door, and I look for them to come in and talk to me, to advise me on the needs of Alaska. And the fact that Richard Glenn is sitting right next to me, one of the things that was not mentioned is he's Alaska Native liaison in one of his positions and works with us in the special representative's office to give us the views of Alaska Natives as we go forward. So this has been an iterative process that's gone on for years. The White House itself does consulting on their own, and that all comes into play when decisions are made at the strategic level between the leaders of two countries.
So, Richard Glenn, what have you heard from Alaska Native leaders about this concept or plan or idea between our two nations, the U.S. and Canada, either from the ANC side, Alaska Native Corporation side, or tribal leaders? What have you heard about this idea going forward?
Well, first of all, I can attest to and I admire the fact that Admiral Papp has looked out to the Native community for some support, liaison, access. And while I've yet to really formally engage in that role, I think it's a anyway, I just applaud the fact that he's looking and continues to look to the Native community for additional support. I've read the press releases of our delegation. I've read the press releases of our leadership and our ANCs and our governmental organizations. And I guess the short answer is that we are concerned for the well-being of our residents. We know that our communities are in a precarious position, and we know that our children need to have reliable power, running water, healthy communities, and anything that pushes us in that direction is a plus.
All right, if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking about the Arctic and the future of the Arctic as this big international gathering takes place in Fairbanks this week. You can join our conversation. We have Admiral Robert Papp, the State Department's Arctic representative, on the line with us from KUAC, and Richard Glenn, who is with ASRC and is an Arctic science expert. He is also on the line from KUAC in Fairbanks. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. Or if you're calling in Anchorage, you can call 550-8422, 550-8422, or email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Admiral Papp, please tell us about this big international gathering taking place in Fairbanks this week and your role in it.
Well, those of us at the State Department that work on what we call Team Arctic have been calling this week up here March Madness, with apologies to the NCAA, because I think they've coined that phrase for their basketball tournament. But we have a number of things that are going on this week. And in fact, there have been peripheral meetings that have been going on leading up to this. Some of the task forces and work groups of the Arctic Council have been working. In fact, one of them was up in Barrow just prior to this. But this week here in Fairbanks, we have the Arctic Science Summit. We have the Arctic Observing Summit. We have the Model Arctic Council, which is over 100 students from around the world participating in how they think the Arctic Council ought to work. We have the Arctic Youth Ambassadors. And then most importantly for me and my staff, we have a meeting of the senior Arctic officials of the Arctic Council occurring here. So as Mayor Castle said yesterday, there's not a single hotel room available in Fairbanks. We have the city packed. Fairbanks has rolled out the red carpet for all of us, and we're just enjoying our visit here while getting some very vital business taken care of at the same time.
And Richard Glenn, what are you participating in this week in Fairbanks, and are you bringing a message to those assembled in Fairbanks from the people who live in Arctic Alaska?
Well, you prefaced the show today with the fact that students, Native organizers, government leaders, and officials would be attending this conference. And I think I've been every one of those, especially here centered around Fairbanks. This is a great location for Arctic research. Many of my colleagues and friends are at the West Ridge at the Geophysical Institute, where I've studied sea ice and our changing oceans for many years. And I think this is a perfect forum to bring the right mix of policymakers, researchers, and community representatives together. My goal is to hopefully just bring a voice of truth from our communities so that we can remain engaged as these policy decisions are being made. You know, we have so many organizations, so many layers of opportunities for engagement that start at the United Nations and go all the way down to the city council level. And it takes a lot of work to make sure that your voice is represented when decisions are being made. And that's my goal. And I'm optimistic that we'll have many opportunities at many levels for it at these gatherings.
Well, and continuing in that idea of many levels, you're a person who is kind of straddling many different positions. You're on you're a vice president with ASRC, one of the Alaska Native corporations. You're also a whaling co-captain. So You're on both the business side and the traditional side of your life in the Arctic, and also working with the State Department. So you're on the federal side as well. When you talk about that voice of truth coming from the people of the Arctic, what are you hearing about the concerns that they're expressing and want you to help carry that message forward?
Well, there's several. I mean, we live in a changing world, and it's changing in many ways. The physical changes that are observed are most easily seen in the presence or the absence of a multi-year sea ice cover, right? So we have a changing ocean. But superimposed on top of that are communities. And the communities are cities and villages and towns. And I think we do a disservice to ourselves when we kind of relegate our communities to a village status. It seems to diminish some of the needs that these communities have. We have real world needs. We have water and sewer plants and power plants and schools, and our roads need snow removal and fire safety and public safety. And so we're basically small cities with real city needs. And then that means that to answer to those needs, we need continued development in our region. The real truth is that none of the villages in our region, in northern and northwestern Alaska probably, and maybe in the circumpolar Arctic, can really persist and survive unless there is an economy there for the region to support. So, and at the same time, we depend on a clean environment for our sustenance, our subsistence, our food, and basically our spirit. It seems like a conflict, but I think the whole world should be similarly conflicted.
And it is an area that, as tough and fierce as the Arctic can be, is also incredibly fragile as far as an ecosystem. So that balance is paramount there. Do you feel like if we can get it right in the Arctic, that maybe that bodes well for other places in the world because of the fragility of the system that's in the Arctic?
So, yeah, you like to talk about the fragility of the system, where I like to look at the durability of the system. You can find examples of both, depending on where you look, in any part of the world. So instead of, I guess I look at it a little differently.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the Arctic. And you can join our conversation. We've got Admiral Robert Papp on the line and Richard Glenn with ASRC, and he's also an Arctic scientist. So they are on the line with us from KUAC in Fairbanks, where there is a big international Arctic conference underway. You can call us at 1-800-478-8255 statewide, 1-800-478-8255. Locally, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422, or email us talk@alaskapublic.org. And we have a caller on the line. Mark is in Bethel. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Richard and Admiral. I'm a Coast Guard veteran. I came to Alaska in 1976 to the Loran Station down at Hoke. I'm wondering, in the research planning, Arctic research planning, how much emphasis is being given by the United States in data rescue? You know, we've got the opportunity to build a really big historical model of the Bering Sea just by going through and extracting logbook data from from the fisheries and from commercial and military vessels, similar to what the European Union did with the CLEWOC project, where they made some climate models off of logbooks from sailing ships back when they first started using the Beaufort scale, and they suddenly had a uniform way to measure wind speed across the different fleets. So I know there's a couple of efforts by NOAA to extract some submarine records, but is there anything, is there any sort of a comprehensive data rescue project going on to build some historical climate models, in the oceans and particularly in the Bering Sea?
Well, first, Mark, let me say it's great for me to talk to a fellow Coastie, and you and I were up in Alaska at the same time. I arrived in 1975 on the Ironwood out in Adak, and you were at the Loran station. I visited many of the Loran stations during the 2 years I was up here, but it's really nice to, at least by over technology, have a chance to talk to somebody who went through some of the same experiences. Look, I think one of the things that is very important to us is I call it networking. For instance, right now, one of the goals of the Arctic Council under the U.S. chairmanship is to come up with a comprehensive science agreement. There are so many disparate efforts going on by the eight countries collecting data, processing information, but none of it is shared. None of it is provided to others. So I think we're tremendously inefficient in terms of gathering data and then analyzing it and then knitting it all together. We've started a couple of efforts, the search and rescue agreement in 2011, the marine oil spill preparedness and response agreement in 2013, which starts to delineate and get the countries working together on various issues. But we really have a long ways to go in terms of science, in terms of oceanography, charting, and things of that sort. And it starts with us giving it attention in the United States and analyzing and putting together the data that we have. And you only do that once you work through the political process and start raising awareness of the Arctic and the importance of it. And that's why I've been working for many years. In fact, the first time I met Richard Glenn was probably about 6 years ago and during my first visit to Barrow as the Commandant of the Coast Guard. And learning more about the people of the region, but also trying to get the interagency in Washington to work together to be able to pool our resources for these very important efforts. NOAA is working on the data that you talk about, and it's part of our plan that's now gathered under the Arctic Executive Steering Committee, which was started by a presidential order about a year ago. And we're starting to make progress, and it has paid off with now increased funding to go to NOAA and some of the other agencies to complete these projects.
Well, thanks for the call, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Admiral, I want to kind of continue on that theme. In a recent speech in Tromsø, Norway, you said you hoped that criticism that the U.S. doesn't have a long-term commitment to the Arctic has been dispelled. Next month will mark the halfway point for the U.S. chairing the Arctic Council. What's been accomplished to date?
Well, we've had three internal goals. One is to raise the awareness of the Arctic, and I think that is absolutely the most important thing that we could have done coming out of the gates during our chairmanship. And it's not necessarily required for the other countries because most of the other countries are very well connected with their Arctic. People in the lower 48 tend to forget Alaska, and even within Alaska, the North Slope and other areas don't necessarily get the attention that they deserve, but that's beginning to change. The Glacier Conference that we held in Anchorage last August was our step, big step forward to gain the attention of the lower 48 and the Congress to start making some concrete actions. And you can't do that unless you get your leader up here. So we were so grateful that not only did the president come in to speak at that conference, which we were hopeful that he would do, but then to get 3 days in Alaska afterwards was just monumental. And I can tell you that I myself have observed at the White House a renewed enthusiasm. I talked to one of his senior staffers who said the president was personally touched by the Alaskans that he had a chance to interact with, and that it had become his number one priority was to do things for Alaska. And we've seen it come through with concrete proposals in the FY17 budget, the fiscal year 17 budget that he's transmitted to the Congress. It's probably not as much as some of us were looking for, but on the other hand, it's a lot more than what we've had in previous budgets. So I'll take that progress. However slight it might be, we're making progress.
You mentioned three goals.
Yes.
The first was raise awareness in the Arctic.
Yes. The other thing is strength. The second is strengthening the Arctic Council. The Arctic Council is a remarkable body. It's really, in essence, it's called an international forum, which means it's voluntary, and it's not done by votes. Anything that we do in the Arctic Council has to be done by the consensus of all eight of the countries involved, which means you have to work diplomatically. You have to convince people, and we are just so grateful that we are able to take a very balanced but ambitious United States chairmanship program, sell that to the other countries, and gain the consensus of the other seven countries to support it. But part of the process is to make the body even stronger. The six permanent participants, the groups that represent the indigenous peoples of the Arctic, is probably, I think, the most important component of the Arctic Council. And we need to increase consultation. They have to give their voice to everything that we do. We don't look for consensus from the permanent participants, but we certainly look to them for guidance, for traditional knowledge, and for their opinions on anything that goes forward. And then we have observer states. Some of them are countries, some of them are non-governmental organizations, but 32 observers that have a chance to provide us input as well. And we've made an effort to be more attentive to the observers, and we're going to be more rigorous in terms of what we expect of those observers, which will once again strengthen the Arctic Council. We have Tara Sweeney, who's the chairman of the Arctic Economic Council that has just recently set up its secretariat in Tromsø, Norway, along with the Arctic Council Secretariat. All these things, all these moves are strengthening the work that's done within the Arctic Council. And then the third thing was to introduce long-term goals and objectives. I think, personally, that we've had too much focus over the 20 years of existence of the Arctic Council in segments of 2 years. A country will take the chairmanship and set a program, and then at the end of those 2 years, we raise the flag and either declare victory or defeat, and then we start a new program. We want to introduce things that will have long-lasting impact, will be carried on by Finland in the next chairmanship and then the chairmanship after that. So those are the three goals, and I think we've made great progress on all of them.
All right. Thanks for that. I want to remind our listeners that this is Talk of Alaska. You can join our conversation if you'd like to. Statewide, 1-800-478-8255. Locally, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Mr. Glenn, Richard Glenn, the idea of gathering one of the goals, increased part of one of the goals is increased participation by the permanent observers. That's the people of the Arctic. As right. You well know, having grown up there, you are someone of the Arctic. There is a tremendous amount of traditional knowledge that is science. You can call it traditional knowledge, or you could easily call it science, because that's what it is. What is being done to aggregate that? I know that there's been efforts throughout the years, but it seems like it's been sort of a piecemeal fashion. Maybe I'm not correct about that. Are there efforts underway under the U.S. leadership of the Arctic Council and in involved with your work to help really pull all of that great body of historical science, traditional knowledge together to help inform some of the things that Admiral Papp was talking about?
Sure. First of all, I'm thankful that the organizations like the Inuit Circumpolar Council, Arctic Economic Council, and the leadership there, people like Jimmy Stotts and Tara Sweeney, I'm glad that they're there, because you could spend all your time going from meetings to meetings, and I'm sure the Admiral knows this, and almost never go home and still not think that you've attended enough Arctic-themed meetings around the world. And organizations like the Inuit Circumpolar Council are like a pilot light. They've always been there. They've always sent representation, and they try to send the best of the best per the theme of the meeting that's being called, wherever it's being held. And with that goal in mind, to contribute local expertise, local knowledge. For me, that whole issue of how to obtain or elicit traditional knowledge is a deeply personal thing. And I spent a lot of years of my life with that goal in mind, not just for me trying to understand my own natural world and the way our people fit in it, but also to try to help others. And there's three really good ways to obtain traditional knowledge. And the first one is easy. Get in line. You know, someone ahead of you has learned something already. And if he's willing to impart that lesson to you, that's a great exchange right there. And the second is there has to be an element of trust between the person who's seeking this traditional knowledge and the person who's sharing it. If that trust isn't there, then you will not succeed from the very beginning. And finally, I think if the folks who are interested in seeking this local information, traditional knowledge, and the folks who are giving it share a common goal, then you have a reason to share. And then there's that generates great synergies. My point is, if all of these things can occur and you have a student next to a teacher or two colleagues basically talking about something that they're both experts in, let's say our best caribou man talks to a caribou biologist, for example. If you can take the best of the best meeting with each other, the cultural differences almost disappear, and you get colleagues talking to each other. And if you've ever been in a room when that happens, and I have many times in my life, it's like the swish in a basketball game. There's nothing better.
And Lori, if I could jump in here, let me give you one concrete example of what I think you're looking for and what Richard is talking about. One of the projects we have for our chairmanship is something called CLEO, C-L-E-O. It's the Circumpolar Local Environmental Observer Network. Mm-hmm. And what it does is, you know, NOAA and other agencies can put monitoring equipment at various locations. And certainly other countries have scientific monitoring things, but it gives you raw data. It observes what's there now. But if you can take the indigenous people or indigenous communities circumpolar and have them provide observations, not only do you get the observation, but you get interpretations. In other words, science is generally objective, but there's a subjective portion of how this all fits together, which is provided by the local people who have knowledge that goes back years. For instance, Richard, I asked him how things were back home, and he was telling me about the ice this year and how it's not come up to the shore because the wind's blowing this direction, which is unusual because whether it's El Nino or change in the Gulf Stream or whatever it might be, but he has interpretations of the observation, which is valuable to scientists and other people that are doing the work.
Interesting to really have that fleshed out and the idea that trust is a big component of this. Thanks so much for that. We're going to continue this conversation, this interesting conversation about all things Arctic, and we'll take some more calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the future of the Arctic with Admiral Robert Papp, who is the State Department's Arctic representative. He is joining us from KUAC in Fairbanks, where there is a big Arctic conference going on. Also on the line is Richard Glenn. He is with ASRC, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. He's also a geologist and Arctic science expert, and he is also joining us from KUAC. We're going to go back to the phones. Charles is in Anchorage. Hi, Charles.
Hello.
Do you have a question?
So I had a question. I had a question for both the Admiral and for Richard Glenn. So when looking at the potential for increased maritime traffic in the Arctic region, both Innocent Passage within 12 nautical and 24 nautical miles, and the freedom of the high seas for areas beyond that, in my mind, it poses some threat to the subsistence hunting activity in the far north. So I was wondering, firstly, to Richard, is this a concern for the people of the North Slope? And for the Admiral, is there any effort being undertaken by the United States to try to put some sort of mandatory shipping lanes or shipping routes on the North Slope area?
So the first part of your question is yes, but it's more focused toward the choke point of the Bering Strait than, for example, the coastline of the North Slope. If you look at ship-bound traffic, and the Admiral can talk about this better than me, it's probably like a 90 to 10 split in terms of international traffic going through the Bering Straits and turning left through the Northern Sea Route rather than turning right through the Northwest Passage. That being said, you know that we have annual visits of many vessels of many types. We've got fuel barges that visit every community. We have the occasional adventurer or cruise ship, and we have the Coast Guard and other research vessels that continually go through our waters as well. If you look out over the ocean from where we live, we see vessels in the months of July and August especially, but and at other times during the year, depending on what kind they are, but they must pale in comparison to the folks who live, for example, in Wales and St. Lawrence Island, where there's a natural geographic choke point. And I think the Admiral probably also is better prepared to talk to you about the idea of shipping lanes, because they are in the works for that part of the world.
Yeah, so you brought up a great subject that I could speak for hours on, because I'm certainly interested in being the former Commandant of the Coast Guard. And that's really why I started coming up here nearly 6 years ago, is because of this increase in human activity that was brought on by really two aspects, the drilling operations in the Chukchi Sea and the increase in traffic along the northern sea route of Russia that ultimately ends up at that choke point called the Bering Strait. As an operator, as a Coast Guardsman, I really viewed the most important area as that choke point. The United States Navy looks at choke points strategically around the world because of warfighting potential. I looked at it as a choke point for safety of shipping, safety of people, and pollution prevention responsibilities. So. It's a very important strategic area, and yes, we are getting prepared for it in a very comprehensive manner. The first thing is the International Maritime Organization, which is a body of the United Nations, has been working. In fact, they have produced the first version of the Polar Code. A lot of people have made the case that the Polar Code does not go far enough, but it's like anything else in diplomacy and politics. You take what you can get by compromise and consensus and get that into effect, and then start working on the next version, which we're doing now. And certainly the Arctic Council has a lot of opinions and a lot of advice that we're advocating with the IMO in terms of preparation for shipping and people in the Arctic. On a more tactical and regional level, the United States Coast Guard is looking at a study on how do we have traffic routes going through the Bering Strait. We can't do that unilaterally. I mean, we can within U.S. waters, but ultimately what we'd like to have is an upbound and downbound system within the Bering Strait to keep traffic apart. And that has to be done. That has to be worked out with the Russians. So we are working diplomatically to come to an agreement with the Russians, while at the same time, the United States Coast Guard is meeting with the Alaska Natives and other groups, so that when we put these routes in, we avoid whale migratory routes, fishing areas, and other things, so that we can steer that traffic away from it, while at the same time making sure that we protect pristine coastline as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Charles. We're going to go back to the phones again. Sue is in Nome, and this might kind of be a follow-up to Arctic shipping. She has a question or a comment about maps. Hi, Sue.
Hi, thank you. This has been such a deep and important conversation. I feel like my comment may be a little superficial, but I live in Nome, and I have taken to carrying a little card in my wallet that shows the size of Alaska laid over the lower 48. And in terms of building awareness, I bring this up because it's crazy to us who live here. But every lower 48er I have shown this to is stunned because they really do think Alaska is about half the size of Texas because that's what they see on maps. And I just wondered how much, in terms of raising awareness, you know, are you bringing to the general public? I just think, I'm hoping that you're showing them, you know, that the Arctic runs like from Illinois to Montana, because for the most part, the general public doesn't appreciate just how much Arctic coastline America has. So I just wanted to put that out there. And then I also wanted to put in a plug for a Coast Guard station here in Nome. We just had a rescue in the Bering Straits that required launching a helicopter and a plane, I think maybe it was two helicopters, out of Kodiak. And with all of this, you know, increased attention and traffic, we really need a Coast Guard presence further north. It's not known someplace. And then also, I'm very relieved to hear that you are working closely with the Russians, because we live so very close, and the oil or the problems or the disasters don't stay on one side of that imaginary line or another. So those were mostly my comments, and to thank you all for your focus, especially that on garnering traditional knowledge. That's obviously very critical.
Well, thanks. And it's I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say thanks for the call, Sue. And Admiral Papp, please respond.
Oh, Sue. Sir, Lori, and back to Sue. Thanks for that call from Nome. Every time I think of Nome, I smile because I marched in the Bicentennial Parade in 1976 down the main street of Nome while my ship was anchored off of Nome before we proceeded up into the Arctic Ocean. You're absolutely right. I count as one of the greatest benefits of my Coast Guard career was serving my first 2 years in Alaska. And when I talk to young Coast Guardsmen or even the public, I talk about it was beneficial to me to learn the complexities and the size of Alaska, and that anybody up here has to work with what I refer to as the tyranny of time and distance that is brought on, and the remoteness as well. So, yes, that's part of our awareness, and we make every effort to do that. Part of the problem that we face is that most projections of the world on maps distorts things because it's optimized for the middle latitudes and not the north. And you're lucky sometimes. Most of the time when they put out maps, they cut off the Arctic and the Antarctic just for aesthetic purposes. So we're in the process of reminding people of that all the time. You mentioned Russia. We are obviously there is tension between us and Russia for their activities in Ukraine and their annexation of Crimea, and there are sanctions in place that are addressing that. And we continue to make sure that we hold Russia accountable for their actions there. But at the same time, we have to realize to make any progress in the Arctic, we have to have Russia on board. They have half the coastline in the Arctic. And they are a key player within the Arctic Council. So I think it is possible to continue peaceful progress and relations with Russia on specific subjects while at the same time addressing their activities in the rest of the world.
Admiral Papp, I wanted to kind of continue on that theme, the frosty relationship with Russia that we have right now. Does the U.S. have insight into the vessels that travel on the Russian side through the Northern Sea Route? Is there still sharing, or is there sharing of information about who those vessels, who they are, where they're coming from, what they're hauling, and where they're going to? How much is known about that?
We have pretty good knowledge, and To be truthful, the increase in traffic along the Northern Sea Route has not been as substantial as was once projected. Part of that is because there are fairly significant fees that Russia's charging. They require escorts by Russian icebreakers, which makes it a little bit more costly. And as much as it's opening up, it's still a little unpredictable. The ice is unpredictable right now. And I think that a lot of the shipping companies have decided it's not a viable sea route for them, particularly when you're carrying container traffic, because container traffic is just-in-time delivery, and they have to maintain fairly rigorous schedules. Now, there are energy shipments that are going along the Northern Sea Route, which a lot is going from the Barents Sea, Norwegian energy products that are going to China. And that's one of the reasons why China has been so active and doing research in the Arctic, because they recognize and acknowledge that in the future, if the oceans continue to open up as they are predicted, there are going to be significant savings in terms of shipping days, which equates to money and prosperity. And they're looking at that, as are other countries that are intent. This is something that's been going on for probably close to four centuries, as people have looked for shorter routes between Europe and the Far East. And that's why there's been this search for the Northwest Passage for so many years, because time is money. And if shippers can cut days off their transits, they're going to do that. And I expect that to continue to increase in the future.
And I do want to continue on that theme in just a moment, but let's go back to the phones now and hear from Odin in Fairbanks. Hi, Odin.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to thank all of you guys for coming on here and talking about the Arctic. I've traveled pretty extensively in Alaska and other parts of the circumpolar north, and I'm very concerned about the way that I've seen climate change affecting communities and ecosystems throughout our state, and by what the future might hold. And I'm helping to organize a testimonial rally today at the Arctic Science Summit Week. It's going to be at noon at UAF Constitution Park, and we're going to have a variety of speakers from the community. And this is part of the Fairbanks Climate Action Coalition. And our purpose is to send a strong message to our leaders and policymakers that we need to stand with climate science in rapidly transitioning away from dirty energy in Alaska and toward a clean energy economy. And so I was wondering if you guys could talk a bit about some of the ways that ordinary people can engage with addressing the issue of climate change and helping to implement the solutions.
All right. Thanks, Odin.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Admiral Papp?
Well, thanks, Odin. It's nice to be here in your city. And we'll listen for your voices out there this afternoon, because I think listening is one of the most important things we do as we develop policy and actions to deal with all this. Look, let me talk more strategically and from a higher level here. When I started this job, in fact, going back to when I was still in the Coast Guard and I was trying to get resourcing and policies for our increase in Arctic activities, I kept looking for what's the national imperative. You know, much of what has been invested in Alaska over the last 60 or 70 years mostly has been driven by national defense concerns, whether it's the Dew Line, the Alcan Highway, and other things, or because of disasters like the Exxon Valdez spill that drove the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. But what was the national imperative today that would cause the lower 48, our members of Congress, the administration, to pay attention to what's going on in Alaska and the Arctic? Well, the president has given us that. One of the president's legacy issues is climate change. And that was why his visit to Alaska was so important, because it demonstrated the changes that are occurring in our Arctic, in our United States Arctic. And that was a prelude to him going to Paris to try to get all these other countries to come to agreements on things that we can do to slow this process. And I'm a believer we can do that. I've looked at things like the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, that have improved our environment in the United States. And I think if we can bring countries together to address this challenge of climate change, I think we as human beings can make a difference. And we have to listen to voices like yours. And you have to continue to speak loudly and forcefully to make sure that we continue to remind our leaders and our elected leaders that they have a responsibility to give attention to this issue.
Thanks for the call, Odin. I wanted to get a question in before we go back to traffic in the Arctic about health and wellness issues for Arctic people. And Richard Glenn, maybe this is something that you could start off with. Are there baseline studies being undertaken to assess how Arctic people feel about their lives now and what is happening both environmentally, economically, subsistence-wise? Are there studies being undertaken so that as things change, health and wellness, in a very broad sense, can be tracked?
I chuckled at the question because I think there's probably an unending set of studies on various forms of health and wellness. And I kind of harken back to the previous question, which is the issue of climate change, whose effects are real and are being felt in the Arctic. It's not disputed at all. And yet, this is where the devil is in the details for me, because our regions depend on continued development for their survival. That means the schools that my children and grandchildren go to and the health clinics that have generated an increased quality of life. You know, our children are not washing their hand in third string wash basin water anymore. They have clean running water and healthy sanitary facilities, reliable power, basically a better quality of life thanks to the resource development that's been going on in the area. And yet the effects of climate change are real. So this is where the world makes a quick, a logical jump that I don't see, which is if you want to change the world, if you want to slow down the effects of climate change, we should all be in that struggle together. And yet to do so basically on the backs of the residents of the Arctic seems to be a double negative. So turn down the thermostat in New Jersey. If you want to start using less dirty fuel, go clean the air, the special areas in the lower latitudes, or look at energy diversity everywhere and not first in the Arctic, where at the present, for the past 50 years and maybe for the next 50 more, our children and our grandchildren will depend on continued responsible resource development for the survival of their communities.
Yeah, Lori, Richard is exactly right, and that's why Paris was so important. Yeah, people are fond of saying, I heard it this morning at the opening session here, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. But the converse is true as well. What happens in the rest of the world affects the Arctic, whether it's methane production, CO2, black carbon that's produced. All of this comes to the Arctic and has an effect. So that's why it's so important to get the observer nations, large economies like China and the European Union, to take on these new standards of limiting CO2 emissions and other things that will help us in this fight against climate change.
All right. Thank you so much for that. We are going to take one more quick break. And when we come back, we will continue our conversation about the Arctic as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
The Elder Mentor Program is seeking low-income seniors age 55 or older who have a passion for children and for sharing cultural values. Eligibility information at ruralcap.com. This message sponsored by Rural Alaska Community Action Program, Inc.
The Salmon Project is all about the ways Alaskans' lives are supported by salmon. Their vision is for a future where Alaskans continue to be strong, nourished, and connected through Alaska's salmon resource. Learn more and be part of the project, including their regular fun competitions. Our lives are salmon lives. Learn more at salmonproject.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
We Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Admiral Papp and Richard Glenn, when Sue in Nome called and wanted to talk about maps, I thought maybe she was going to mention modernizing charts for the seas. But she had an interesting question about other types of maps. But I wanted to ask about that, the issue of getting modern charts for the Bering, the Chukchi, the Beaufort Seas. What's happening on that front?
Well, I tell people when I talked about my my ancient history of being up here in the mid-70s as a sailor, we often went into places around the Bering Sea in Kuskokwim Bay, Norton Sound, and Kotzebue and other places with handmade charts that had been developed over the years by the ship. And its previous crew and sailors, because we had to get into certain locations and there just weren't charts that were produced. I have looked at some charts and I've confirmed this with the oceanographer of the Navy that some of the soundings off the North Slope actually go back to the days of Captain Cook in the late 1700s when Great Britain was exploring for the Northwest Passage by going up through the Bering Strait and around the North Slope. They were taking soundings with what we call lead lines, you know, a piece of heavy weight on a length of line that takes the depth. And I have, in fact, seen some older charts that it looks like it is the transit of Captain Cook that those soundings came from. So part of what the president has put in the budget is increased funding to start doing some mapping and oceanography work, which will help to contribute to better charting of the area, and I'm encouraged by that.
I can attest to the inadequacy of charts in places where we travel over open water in the summertime, where there used to be barrier islands, for example, and barrier islands have a way of moving around. And so if you use a GPS chart plotter screen, it will show your boat traveling over what used to be an island. But also, in line with the woman from Nome who called, I too have experienced the lack of geographic awareness in our national leadership when trying to discuss issues related to Alaska. And the coastline is a great tool for trying to bring some awareness. If you, for example, superimpose the coastline of the North Slope on the eastern seaboard, you will go from Point Hope to the Canadian border in Alaska, of course, and if you center Washington, D.C., right about where Point Barrow is, you'll run from New Jersey all the way down south past Savannah, Georgia, in one stretch of coastline. And if you think where we live, there's only a handful of communities surrounded by miles and miles of open tundra, and you look at the metropolises that exist on the eastern seaboard, the difference starts to be real. Mm-hmm. And yet both regions have their special places. Both regions have their beautiful places. And so to relegate us to five or six communities along the coast and nothing in between is like saying we could only live at Plymouth Rock and Boston and Savannah and a few other places and nothing else. You know, it's not realistic, of course, but it does jostle the awareness of the folks, the policymakers in places like Washington, D.C.
And one of the things that I'm fond of saying back in Washington, D.C. that illustrates the challenge that we face in gaining attention and raising awareness of the Alaskan Arctic is when I'm in Washington, D.C. talking to groups, I say where we sit right now is 3,500 miles from Barrow, Alaska, our northernmost city in Alaska. So we're 3,500 miles, and there's an awful lot of Canada in between. So we are literally and figuratively disconnected from our American Arctic, whereas Canada, I'm really envious of the other countries because they have this connection, and it's a part of their culture. It's not within the United States, and that's why I keep harking back to this raising awareness as being one of the most important things that we do.
Absolutely. And I wanted to get a question in about You had said, Admiral, that there isn't as much traffic transiting through either the Northwest Passage or the Northern Sea Route as people had thought there might be by this point in time. But the Marine Exchange tracks vessels that have transponders, but only if they have a transponder. One of the things that Ed Page had said with the Marine Exchange is that his biggest concern for the future is with enormous cargo vessels, ships that are 1,300 feet long, carry thousands of containers. And he said, there's no tug that's going to be able to deal with this. He said, if Mother Nature decides it wants to take that ship, all you're going to be able to do is watch it unfold. In our final minute or so, what are your biggest concerns for this next decade in the Arctic? Both Admiral Papp and Richard Glenn, we've got about 2 minutes.
Yeah, and I hate to going back to my previous Coast Guard career, but I spent 4 decades doing that. So, and a lot of that has been imprinted in our chairmanship program under the Arctic Ocean Safety, Security, and Stewardship portion. And I'm really proud of that because while the Arctic Council does have the Search and Rescue Agreement and the Marine Oil Spill Prevention and Response Agreement, those things haven't been exercised. And as an operator, I always want to know, will they work? And one of the things we're very proud of is we now have an Arctic Coast Guard Forum. We have brought together the 8 Coast Guards of the Arctic and signed an agreement to create this forum, and they are working together. And the most obvious thing that they're doing is they've already held a tabletop exercise for search and rescue in Anchorage last fall. And this next summer, they're going to do a full-blown operational exercise where they will actually get ships and aircraft out there and learn how we operate together in the Arctic. So that's going to be very important to us because right now we don't know if we can rescue a large cruise ship. Mm. We don't know if we can rescue a large container ship going through there or an oil tanker. And I would add that one of the other very important issues for Alaska is we need a deep water port up north. And I know Nome's been looking at it, Port Clarence is mentioned, Kotzebue is mentioned, but we need a deep water port near the Bering Strait to serve as both a harbor of refuge, a place to refuel, get repairs, and other things. And over the next decade, some decisions need to be made on that. We need to develop that infrastructure. We need to develop communications infrastructure. And I would say, going back to the question from Nome, yes, we need a Coast Guard air station that's closer to the Northwest Passage and the North Slope than Kodiak, Alaska, which is about 800 miles away.
Absolutely. And Richard Glenn, in the final few seconds here, what's your big concern for the next decade?
I echo the main points that the Admiral raised. Having had to weather out a storm at Port Clarence in an 18-foot skiff, I can attest to the shelter that place brings. And I agree that that's a natural and a strong need. In addition to the points you raised, though, I also think that the continued viability of Arctic communities is going to figure large in my own priorities for the next decade, and that policy leaders can really understand what it takes for communities to survive in the Arctic.
All right. Thank you so much to my guests, Admiral Papp and Richard Glenn, and to KUAC in Fairbanks for helping us out, Dave Waldron on the board and Josh Edge on phones. I'm Laurie Townsend. We'll
Talk
be back
Alaska
next week.
Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're looking for a career that will put you to work immediately without any educational debt, think about the apprenticeship program and learn to become a construction craft laborer. The construction industry requires hard work, provides great pay, and a bright future while building Alaska. Application deadline for the apprenticeship program is March 31st. Call to begin your debt-free career track today, 907-345-3853. This message sponsored by Alaska Laborers Training School. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.